This is exactly right.
It's me, Roz. Happy Halloween time. I can't think of a better guest to be joined by than Michelle Bellinger, who has been on this show before. People went crazy for her. So, gotta get her back on. And I'm hoping this won't be the last time. And if you don't know who Michelle is, she's been on TV shows like Paranormal State and one of my favorites, Portals to Hell. And she's been on this show also. And so if you want to go back and hear more about her haunted Airbnb, her psychic abilities, she's also a demonologist. You can go back and listen. Actually, not that long ago, maybe 6 months ago or so, she was on the show that was posted on April 15th, and it was a two-parter, so also April 22nd. So go check that out as well. She also has a great website that is very comprehensive. She's written a lot of books as well. So on this week's episode today, we're going to be talking more about that haunted Airbnb of hers and, protecting yourself from dark energies. And we get into psychic vampirism, which is something I don't think has ever come up on this show. And this is also going to be a two-parter. So we'll have more to talk about next week with Michelle as well. And this week on Patreon, I asked her a question I've always wondered. Can human spirits possess living humans? You know what I mean? Like, it's always talking about these demons are possessing people. But, like, you know, could just, like, you know, your good old-fashioned ghost get inside of a human? And Michelle had an answer and an incredible story to share. So that's on my second tier of Patreon, patreon.com/RozDresFelez. And while I'm promoting things, I should also tell you that indeed the first live show back after lockdown and everything, a COVID-safe ghosted live show in Los Angeles, has sold out. So I've decided to add another show, and I'm going to do that on Saturday of Halloween weekend. So it's Saturday, the 30th of October, and that is at the Cavern Club Celebrity Theater at Casita del Campo, gorgeous Mexican restaurant. Go eat some Mexican food and then come on down to the little theater that people say is haunted. And I've got some silly, you know, just typical Roz, stupid, silly, paranormal comedy for you. And I'm also going to have a surprise guest or two. Different shows, different nights. Different guests, different nights. I'm sure there'll be similarities between the shows. So if you're able to go, that will be the 30th. I have the ticket link in the description of this episode. And also in there, the Ghosted merch link is back up. It was down for a minute. It's back. I've got pins. I've got stickers. I've got t-shirts. I've got tote bags. You can find all of that in the description of this episode. Okay. I think it's time to get into another conversation with one of my favorite guests, Michelle Bellinger. On with the show. I am so honored to be joined again by one of the most brilliant minds on the occult, the paranormal, the supernatural, all the things that we love to talk about. Michelle Bellinger, welcome back.
Hello, thank you for having me again.
I loved having you last time, and you answered so many of my questions, and don't you worry, I have got, I've got a lot more for you. I was actually just watching, I stumbled upon this show that I've fallen in love with on Netflix. It's called, what is it called? The world's most amazing vacation rentals. And who do I see but you and the B&B, your Airbnb, your haunted Airbnb that we talked about the last time you were here. And I loved it. How was that? How was that experience having them come by?
The hardest thing was keeping quiet about it for nearly 2 years, because that was in the works for a while and the pandemic sort of hung it up a little bit. But they were so sweet. I love the hosts.
They're so cute. I love them.
So much energy. They were just enthusiastic about everything. And the folks who filmed there were very respectful of the place. And as for Inspiration House's debut on a television show, I couldn't have asked for better, because it was more about the house and its history and why I love it than just trying to make it spooky sensational.
Yeah, because it does seem like a very positive haunting. You know, it's not a spooky haunting from what I've seen and from what you've said. So have you considered, or has it come up, or I don't know if you can answer, I'm not sure, but having other, you know, paranormal shows go to the house?
I am definitely open to the possibility. I know that one thing working against it for that is the fact that it's not a really scary haunting. Yes, multiple people have died in the house, but they all died of natural causes. There's no deep, dark, spooky history. It's just a charming haunting. It is really active, though. Like, the music boxes play by themselves. You hear people walking up and down the halls, doors open and close, the typewriter types. And on multiple occasions, like, the door to the basement will rattle like somebody's on the other side of it. So kind of horror movie level stuff, and yet also nothing threatening, just really physical.
Yeah, because that's the thing, these paranormal shows, they always want it to be the scariest. You know, for the first time in television history, we're gonna see the devil walk through the room.
Yeah.
That's what they want.
But there's any demons at Inspiration House, they are things that I brought there myself with the things in the display room.
You know, we actually, last time you were here, we didn't talk about why the house is haunted. Can mm-hmm. you tell the story of that?
I wish I knew precisely why, but I think it's a combination of the land, the place, the age of the house, and possibly what it's constructed of. Something about Inspiration House really holds onto energy and emotional impressions. And this is something that we find in a lot of classic hauntings. Every place from Waverly Hills to Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum to all the haunted prisons, most of them are of a brick or stone construction. I mean, that's not exclusive, but an awful lot of them are. And something about where they're at and the length of time that people either stayed there or had strong emotional experiences there seems to wear its way into the fabric of the space. And Inspiration House is no different.
Huh. Yeah, because I've heard, is that sort of what like the stone tape theory is?
It's related to it. And some of the stone tape theory comes down to whether or not the stones have a high quartz content. I've heard theories about it being limestone or a high, like ferrous magnet, like a lot of iron influencing electromagnetic forces. Some of that gets into some dodgy pseudoscience, mm-hmm. but there is something interesting about the topography, the actual like geology of locations where haunts seem to occur. And I think it bears a little bit more research than maybe has been given to it over time.
Okay. Yeah, that's something that I feel like I don't hear enough about, like, in, you know, the relationship to the earth, water, you know, all these elements. I think sometimes people look over them and they get so caught up on tragic murders that happen in a location, or just the deaths in general, and they don't think about all of that.
Yeah, and something is definitely about is connected to the land there. Some of that might also be the house was built in 1869, finished in 1870, but there was another house on that property that predated it that does have a very historic connection to the Underground Railroad. Reverend James Fitch and his wife lived there. I believe his brother-in-law lived there as well. And they were connected to something called the Wellington Rescue, where James Fitch ended up in jail for over 100 days. I think it might have been more than a year, protesting the recapture of a freedom seeker, John Price. And it was something that predated the Civil War, but really kind of fanned the flames in a way that we would relate to sort of the George Floyd murder these days, in terms of like public outcry for how people are being treated. John Price was someone who was abducted on his way to work. They beat him, they threw him in a carriage, they drove him one town over where they knew they would be received a little bit more kindly as slave catchers from Kentucky. And Oberlin, which is where Inspiration House is, had been an abolitionist town since its founding. And the brother-in-law of Reverend Fitch heard John Price crying for help. Wow. And there was like this daring carriage race to try to like get to where they were keeping him in prison. A ton of folks from Oberlin showed up. They staged a protest. And while they were keeping everybody occupied in the front, somebody broke John Price out. And the first place they hid him was the Fitch property where Inspiration House currently stands.
Wow. So when you move into this place, when you know, acquire this property, did you know this history or that it might be haunted?
I did not know that history at all. The only reason I started to dig into the Underground Railroad connection was enough of my friends and like local investigators had gotten EVPs and things that started to steer them toward the Underground Railroad. And I was like, but the house was built after the Civil War. That doesn't make sense. And then found that what it was built on was one of the few houses that they knew for sure had hidden passageways and booby traps to better hide people and to deter their capture. So the Fitches were not messing around. Wow. For their whole conductor thing. Like they were pretty into it.
Oh my God. So during the pandemic, or, you know, I guess really since I've talked to you last, which wasn't even that long ago, has there been a lot of activity at the house?
Yeah, I will say that when we were looking for a place to be kind of my location for in-person classes, I'd been hoping for something that was haunted. And when we first walked into Inspiration House, there was definitely a feel to it. So I had a sense that there was going to be something going on there. I really didn't anticipate that I'd hit the jackpot in terms of A, friendly spirits, and B, really physically active ones. With the pandemic, the one downside is I can't do classes and stuff in person anymore, but we do still let people go there and do self-directed stays. So they can stay for a weekend, stay for a week, however long they want, and then just get to know the house. And there's been a lot of that going on and a lot of feedback from people where, you know, over and over again, certain consistent activity is confirmed, including my favorite ghost on the property, a ghost dog.
Oh, I like that. I mean, there's something about ghost dogs that like slightly creeps me out, only because I think that my legs must taste good or something, because dogs always lick my legs. And the thought of feeling a lick on my leg, that I, a disembodied tongue on my leg would scare the shit out of me. I mean, what does this dog do?
People will hear him moving up and down the halls. So like the tekka, 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 tekka of like, you know, clawed feet. People have heard him, especially in the king bedroom, trying to crawl up on the bed. Several people have felt him crawl up on the bed. And he's actually a full-bodied apparition. People have mistaken him for an actual living dog looking out the windows. We have a neighbor we can't convince that we don't have a dog. They all report the same general look of a dog, which actually fits, interestingly, an English setter. And because I am a researcher of an obsessive degree, I was able to find one of the families that moved in at the turn of the century, the early 1900s. They had a dog registered to the American Kennel Association. His name was Nick Gleam, and he was an English setter.
Wow. Who finds that out? I mean, that's a pretty incredible.
I was really lucky. I was poking around through Google Books, just basically Google whacking their names to see where they came up. And since all of it was copyright-free stuff, a circular from the American Kennel Association popped up with the name of one of the residents. And I'm like, well, this is interesting. And then I'm like, holy crap, it's the dog.
Well, so when you said that if there were demons, it could have been because of something you brought in. I mean, why would you say that?
I have what I refer to as my big box of demons. And it's not that there is like actually, you know, demon spirits locked in it. But when I was doing my book, The Dictionary of Demons, for the first edition, there were several sigils that I needed better images of. So on the night of December 31st, 2009, moving to January 1st, 2010, I sat down with some like modern parchment paper and a fountain pen, and I recreated several of these sigils. There's maybe 20, 25 of them. And I didn't want to throw them out. Like, I scanned them, sent them into the publisher. And so there's a big box of these, like, little hand-drawn sigils that I just kind of keep around. They're not necessarily sigils for demons, especially in the magic of the Middle Ages and Renaissance, are less about, while they are used in summoning, they're more used to control and protect yourself from the spirit. And so I usually will warn people if they go poking around the display room, if you open this box and you don't know what you're dealing with, this might be really disconcerting. And also, these are harmless. Really, they're just art unless they are used in a much more elaborate ritual setup than we have on the property or that most people even know how to do currently.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I read the second edition of Ghost Hunter's Guide to the Occult, which I love, and I encourage people listening to this to go out and get it. And the glossary alone, I mean, there's so much good stuff in here. And it made me think a lot about this kind of this idea of, well, your intentions with the first thing I was thinking was like a Ouija board, for example, everyone's favorite topic, a Ouija board. So if you're not looking for trouble or you're not looking to open a door or talk to demons or something, how does it still happen, or does it still happen, or what's going on with that?
Well, I mean, obviously Ouija boards are pretty controversial, although mostly that reputation was earned through the movie The Exorcist. There's a lot of pop culture baggage that comes with this. In the late 1800s, early 20th century, Ouija boards were a parlor game, like literally a way of just sitting around. Sometimes it was an excuse for a lady and her gentleman friend to bend very closely over a table in close quarters and flirt with one another. And okay. Sort of the way that I think in the 70s and the 80s, you would take your girlfriend to, or your friend of choice, to a scary movie and hope that everybody would be so upset that you would have to wrap your hand around them and like pull them in tight to comfort them.
Oh, classic. So, right? The original Netflix and chill.
It really was. But what we see with Ouija boards in their pop culture presentation really gives them a reputation that they don't deserve. They're any other method of spirit communication. You will see people on ghost shows using everything from a K2 meter to an obelisk to a spirit box. And every one of these is using, in theory, a spirit's ability to affect something physical to then give the living audience a physical, palpable communication. Ouija board's no different. The real trouble with the Ouija board is what it probably operates on in most cases, and I would say like probably 95% of the time, something called ideomotor response. Mm-hmm. So you're sitting there with this board and you have a planchette, that's the little pointer, and everybody puts a couple of fingers on that. Or if you're doing it solo, you put your fingers on it. And you're holding your hands over that very carefully, expecting or dreading it to move at some point. Well, our bodies do micro motions. Like there's a small amount of movement that we're doing unconsciously, whether we mean to or not. And with the expectation that this is an object that will move in response to communications, it's very easy for us to set up the expectation and to unconsciously cause it to move. Not even when somebody's trying to fake it, but without meaning to, often the movement is caused by the people who are sitting on the board, which is also why it's so frequently likely to tell you the things that you are expecting to hear, mm-hmm. or the things you hear you fear most.
Right. Well, it's no fun if you're at a slumber party and the Ouija board's just like, "Hi, you look pretty." Like, no, the people they want it to say something terrifying.
I have a slumber party memory with a Ouija board where. And I can only imagine, I know the friends that I was with, though, where we had a long dissertation about which of our teachers were virgins.
But what I'm wondering is, similar to what I was just thinking with a Ouija board, if you have these symbols in your home that, like, for example, I see a lot of Baphomet merch these days, and I think some people might think that that draws demons towards you, or you know, having these items, a pentagram upside down, or you know, these things, can that happen? Are they you know, signals for dark energies?
Not really. A symbol has exactly as much power and meaning as the person who's using it gives to it. Okay. So if you've acquired this because you want to put it on your altar and you are using it as a focal point for the spirit of Baphomet or anything, then it will have more ability to connect to that. But most of that ability is coming from you, the person, than the object. And I've seen that again and again. It's important to keep in mind that some symbols that we as a culture will look at and find incredibly terrifying, a five-pointed star, even an upside-down five-pointed star, has been sort of promoted as a satanic symbol. But if you go back 100 years, 150 years, you may find a five-pointed star, even upside down, as an architectural device, even in certain churches, even as hex symbols on barns in Pennsylvania. It's an old symbol, and it's had many uses. And in order to understand what it's supposed to do, you have to understand the context. So that alone tells us that it's not the symbol itself. It's the intention, it's the use that it's being put to, and it's the people who are making use of it. So if you just buy it because it looks cool and you want to like class up your Halloween sort of spooky atmosphere, you are not going to have a house full of terrifying things unless you really want it.
Ah, okay. Now, but what about the fact that I constantly am the opposite? Like, stay away, stay away, stay away. Does that work that way? Does it really keep them away?
Most spirits are polite and will listen to boundaries when you set them. There are obviously exceptions to the rule, in the same way that there's exceptions to the rule with people. Mm-hmm. Most people, if you say, hey, don't touch me, they will, in fact, respect that. And then there are a few people who are just awful. And the same goes for the spirit world. There are some things that are awful, but they're really not as widespread as so many of the shows and movies make them out to be.
Yeah, well, I'm always talking about ghosts touching people and not asking for consent. Mm-hmm. And they if they want to touch you, they seems like they just go ahead and touch you. But if I walk into a haunted space and say, don't touch me, do you think that will work typically?
I do that all the time. It's the one thing that crosses a line for me, that I do not like to be touched unless I have invited the touch. And that goes for living people, dead people, right, and everything else in between. I make a point of saying, like, basically of setting the rules of engagement. What boundaries of interaction am I willing to tolerate? I don't have a problem with things communicating in images and words, passing emotions along so I can feel them. But, don't grab me.
Have you been grabbed by an unseen force?
A couple of times when I was younger, I had something actually push me down on the bed in a way that I really did not like at a hotel in Wisconsin, Milwaukee. I would have written it off as a night terror, except the same thing happened to my buddy who was sleeping in the room as well. And when we compared notes, we had identical experiences.
Like it pushed you, like you were standing and it pushed you down, or...
No, held me down. I was already down on the bed. Uh-huh. And it was that classic like hag attack of something mm-hmm. like looming over you and pressing you into the bed and not being able to get up. And like I said, I pretty logically was like, oh, this is just sleep paralysis. Mm-hmm. But my buddy was acting kind of cagey as well. And I'm like, hey, are you sleeping okay in this room? And he's like, nope. Tell me what you experienced. And, we're up there for Gen Con. So, or not Gen Con, was it Origins, gaming convention, big geek thing.
Okay. Yeah, I've always felt that sleep paralysis gets real freaky deaky when more than one person experiences it. Or, if anytime someone sleeps in that room, they experience mm-hmm. it. That's when I'm like, I don't know if this is just a sleep paralysis occurrence.
That's usually my measuring stick for whether or not it's not straight up sleep paralysis. If multiple people are experiencing it, or if when someone is experiencing sleep paralysis, someone else in the room or the house is also perceiving something, or if pets are responding to a presence, that makes me want to dig a little deeper into what's going on.
What do you know about the sleeping on your face as opposed to your back, or, sleeping on your stomach mm-hmm. as opposed to your back with sleep paralysis? Because I'm always sleeping on my stomach because I've heard that it doesn't happen if you do that. Is that true?
Anecdotally, if you sleep on your back, you are more prone to it. But I don't know what the statistics are for that, whether or not it's been like 100% scientifically proven. I will say for myself, I do a lot of dream work and a lot of visionary stuff while I'm sleeping. If I want to maintain like a sort of hypnagogic consciousness, like that in between state between sleeping and waking, doing it while on my back is better. I'm more likely to just fall asleep if I roll over onto my side.
Well, let's talk about the occult some more, because now I'm like, I've got so much on my mind from reading your book, and you know a lot about this stuff. I don't know how a human can have so much knowledge. You blow my mind. But I guess let's a simple question. What is the occult?
It really means secret, hidden. I think it the same root word as occluded. I know a lot of people these days will see occult and all they hear is cult and think that it means, you know, dark, satanic, evil. And that's really misleading. Anything that delves into the hidden or mysterious side of our experiences and the world is technically occult. So the paranormal 30, 40, 50 years ago certainly would have still be seen as the occult. We've just kind of rebranded it. These days, I would say that most people who use the term occult or occultist as a personal identifier are folks who are probing, folks who are probing a little more deeply than simply ghost hunting, where there's a little bit more practice of magic, a little bit more ritual research, delving into some of the more forbidden aspects, or at least things perceived to be forbidden, the study not only of human spirits, but of non-human entities, even demons.
Well, that's the part that I can't help it. I'm drawn to the spooky shit.
I mean, me too. 100%.
So what is the benefit of a ghost hunter knowing about the occult?
First and foremost, if you are educated in the occult, you are better able to assess what might actually have happened in a location, confirm or rule out claims that there were rituals or some sort of like satanic sacrifice, because you are able to recognize accurate symbols, accurate relics of ritual activity, as opposed to, you know, some 15-year-old who was listening to too much Ozzy Osbourne and just decided to slap a bunch of weird things on the wall and feel really spooky, which, you know, not to knock that, like there's some fun in that, but it easily gets mistaken for much more formal and effective ritual work. In addition to that, there are a lot of techniques in occult practices for dealing with spirits. Not only experiencing them, but finding ways to protect yourself against them, to protect a space against them, to drive things out, to recognize what's good, what's bad, what's in between, and you don't want to, you know, get on its bad side, but it'll be fine if you leave it alone.
Yeah, the protection part, again, I constantly like, I'll try anything. Like, what crystal do I need to buy? Like, I'm constantly, and it always goes back to the fact that I'm talking about demons all the time and joking, and I just don't want them to show up one day and say, hey, we heard you're running your mouth. But so I definitely am fascinated and curious. The part that I will constantly keep going back to in this book is the parts about protection, which so again, with the intent and that sort of conversation seems to be a pretty big common thread throughout a lot of this is, you know, is saying a prayer or lighting your sage or your Palo Santo, is that enough, or do you need to believe it? Can someone just do that stuff because they read it in a book and they're good to go? Or is there another step to it with the belief?
It definitely helps for it to be meaningful to you. To just grab a bundle of sage and try to act out what you think is a Native American ceremony without context or background, you are not going to have the same result. Which also means if smoke cleansing is something that resonates with you, you don't have to strictly settle for sage. There's a whole history of different types of incense and things that you could use. And I always recommend to people to experiment with what feels like it resonates for them. You know, does Palo Santo seem like it is something that clears things for you better? Are you more of a lavender and rosemary person? I personally like benzoin and sandalwood and frankincense. Actually, not all at once. It's either frankincense or benzoin with a little sandalwood. The idea, especially in terms of smoke cleansing, is that the smoke itself is sort of like the closest physical thing to the energy of the spirit world. And so you're sort of vibing with that to kind of crisscross between your realm and their realm to get this stuff to cleanse. Now, I think it's also important to note that several of the things traditionally used for cleansing, especially with smoke cleansing, also have antibacterial and antiviral properties. So there's a very real likelihood that some of those traditions were handed down to us by our ancestors because they literally helped to clean a space.
Well, what I've also heard in more recent times that sage has really had her moment, and now there's been lots of problems with over-harvesting and just lots of shadiness going on with that. So I think it is good for people to explore other options besides just sage.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of the most popular, most commonly known one. But yeah, I like to hear about the other stuff too. So let's say you don't have access to this stuff, or you don't have any prayers of protection committed to memory. So then what?
So salt, Supernatural got a few things right. Or I should say that the folks who are writing Supernatural clearly read a few books. Salt has been used for cleansing for a long time. It's very popular among a lot of witches, Wiccan practice. You don't necessarily need to use like an entire, you know, box of Morton salt and roll it across the threshold and all of the windows. It's more seen as a sink for negative energy. So in the 80s, I remember Reiki practitioners having like a little bowl of salt or a big salt crystal, one of those pink Tibetan lamps, the supposedly Himalayan rock salt.
I have one just because I heard it might help.
When they were clearing people's energy, or when they felt that they were clearing out negativity, they would then focus it and literally like place it into the salt, almost like the recycling bin. Okay. As a way to sort of imagine sending that back to the earth, or whatever forces then can take it and clear it and cycle the negative out of it without destroying the energy itself. A really quick and easy technique that builds on that, that I've recommended to people, and this is something you can do because you have it in your house. If you feel overwhelmed by something, or there's something you want to let go of, get a little bit of salt, put it in your hand, close your hand around it, think about what you're trying to let go of, and then just wash it off your hand down the sink. Let it go.
Okay.
99% of magic is also psychology. It helps you focus your intention. It gives you a meaningful symbol to kind of hang onto, so you have a tangible thing. So salt, smoke from various things. If you're asthmatic or allergic to smoke, don't worry about it. You don't have to use sage. Water is also another thing that has a long-standing history as a cleansing agent. We see that with like the power of Christ compels you, you know, throwing holy water all over the room. But the Catholics aren't the only ones who have, cornered the market on the idea of holy water. water as something that clears and cleanses and blesses is something you can find in multiple religious systems as well as folk traditions. And again, we've all got that. Just nip into the bathroom. You want to clear something off, put on the tap, put your hands under it, and just let whatever you need to let go of flow down the drain. And also let that sensation of the cool water on your wrists and your hands help you focus on what you want to let go of, and also help you bring yourself back to your body. Being grounded, being centered, reminding yourself that you are in your body in this moment and you are in control is probably the most powerful tool you have for protecting yourself.
There's also the ball of white light. That's something that I hear about a lot.
Yes. That is colloquially called shielding. And it is, again, another technique where you're using a focus to remind yourself that you have boundaries, that you have barriers, that you can be protected. You can do this through your own willpower, where it doesn't have to be a ball of white light. It can be any kind of shield or protective thing. There's a really, really ancient prayer that was adopted into Judaism and Christianity. I don't know if it has a cognate in Islam, and I apologize for that lack, but it goes back to Sumer and Babylon, where you've got Michael on my right and Gabriel on my left. And basically, you space out the four corners with different entities that you find protective. In Sumer and Babylon, it was Shamash and Enki and a couple of other gods that were associated with protection from demons and evil spirits. But you think about being protected at your right and on your left, before you and behind you, above you and below you. And going through those steps, protection on my right hand, protection on my left hand, protection in front of me, protection behind me, protection above me, protection beneath me, helps to orient you, focus you, remind yourself that you have boundaries, that there is a step between you and the rest of the world. Whether you see that as something that you're holding in your mind as a conceptual barrier of white light or whatever, or as something that you are asking for outside of yourself, a higher power, to also facilitate in setting up those boundaries.
So is it too unfocused if somebody, maybe like me, does a little bit of everything?
I don't think that that's too unfocused. I think that there's a lot of power in trying things out and seeing what works for you.
Right.
And really, like, the smorgasbord technique is fine.
That's definitely what's going on over here. So when we're talking about, like, protecting ourselves from energies, this applies to both humans and, you know, otherworldly forces, right?
Yeah.
So can we talk about psychic vampirism, which I know is a topic you know a lot about? I've never talked about this with anybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is it?
Psychic vampirism is the ability some people have to take energy, vitality, spirit from other people. Most of the time, we're presented with the idea of a psychic vampire as a negative person. So think of, there are two broad topics for this, and I will call them old Aunt Edna and that asshole at work, because we've all encountered these, where you've got like this elderly relative who maybe she doesn't get out so much anymore, and she doesn't have a whole lot of like social stimulation. And when you come over to visit, you will hear about every possible bad thing that has gone on in her life, all of the drama from her bunions to her hemorrhoids to the fact that like her dog vomited on her sneakers that day. And like she just, you can feel her, without meaning to, just literally sucking the life and the very will to live out of you. And by the time you're done, you kind of drag ass out and you're just like, oh, but why do I do this to myself? And she's very chipper now that she's, you know, basically sucked you dry of your attention and your emotions, and has almost certainly not the first clue that there was anything other than a conversation in that, that she was what some people might call a vampire.
Okay.
The other person also may not be conscious of it. They might also be, to some extent, aware that they're preying on people. And this is the person who's a little bit more aggressive about it. They still find a way to push buttons. They will usually get up in your personal space. They will find ways to incite strong emotional reactions, usually through confrontation, but sometimes just in guilt or shame. And they will incite this. They will find ways to create charged emotional interactions with people. And they clearly get something out of it. They are motivated by this need to prey off of people to feel more powerful than them. They may also be a hybrid of Aunt Edna. And we see that in What We Do in the Shadows with Colin.
Right.
Who's not necessarily aggressive all the time, but certainly just sucks the life out of people by not letting them go. Just constantly is like, you know, just sipping off of their attention and their focus. So there's some psychological things that can be going on with that. But if you believe that there is such a thing as energy or life force that like Reiki practitioners and Qigong specialists work with, every conversation we have, every interaction with another human being, there's some exchange that happens. And it's usually an equal exchange. Theater people are probably the most keenly aware of how this works. Usually they don't frame it in terms of psychicism or metaphysics. It's simply how theater works. Where if you're up there on the stage and the audience is not engaged, all of the energy you put into your performance just sort of falls flat and you end up exhausted by the end of it.
Oh, yeah. But,
right. You know how that goes. Like there's this feel, but you can feel when you're up on stage when it's clicking, when everything that you're putting out is actually getting put back to you and then some. And so it turns into this reciprocal cycle that is a give and take between you and the audience, where everybody goes home feeling better.
Yeah, stand-up comedy is that. I mean, I've done a lot of stand-up, but I've done a lot of theater, and I've noticed that, like, with stand-up, if it's not going well, you have to figure out how to make it go well. Like, with theater, if it's not going well, you have to keep doing the thing anyway. Mm-hmm. And stand up, it's like, oh no, the energy's off. How do I get this energy back? And that is, it can be very exhausting.
My favorite performer who is aware that this is a psychic effect as well as just how theater works, Dolly Parton.
Ooh. Yes.
There is an interview. There is an interview where she straight up says, I'm a psychic vampire.
Wow.
And what that is and explains how that works and how she uses it as a performer. So the Aunt Edna and the asshole at work representations that I gave, those are folks who don't necessarily know what they're doing. Some people need more energy than others. Sort of makes sense. Like some people are like really, really high energy, some people less so. And some of those people have an inborn ability to take it from others if they need it. And a conscious psychic vampire is someone who's just figured out how that works and can do it consciously. And within the community, there are people who realize that this is a capacity that they have. It's part of their psychic ability, part of like their particular relationship with energy. And they simply choose to do it in ways that are not destructive. See also Dolly Parton, who makes use of enormous crowds to get this cycle going in order to sustain what she needs. Or someone like me, where I will do exchanges with someone who is trained in energy work, has enough to spare, and is consensual in this exchange.
Hmm. So in theory, if a human is a psychic vampire and they die and now they're a ghost. Is the ghost, you know, still a psychic vampire? Suck the life out of you?
Some of the seminal works about psychic vampirism and astral vampirism absolutely say yes. Now, I also think all spirits are vampiric to some degree or another. Every ghost hunter has experienced the fairly widespread battery drain. Mm-hmm. But more than that, the sense of going into a space and feeling really exhausted, like really oppressed on some level when it is a very active haunting. There's a point right before something physical happens in haunted places that everybody can feel a shift in the energy. A lot of people will parse it a little bit like a barometric pressure shift, but many others will feel like something's been taken out of the space in order to fuel this effect. Personally, I believe that all spirits, being energy, need to support what they do and how they exist, and they need to eat, and they can no longer go down to the McDonald's and have a hamburger. So they need to take energy. And I also think that living psychic vampires are folks. I know for a fact that all the living psychic vampires that I know who are at least conscious about it are also fairly powerful energy workers and psychics. They're fueling something, and they need fuel more than what they can eat with just, you know, regular flesh and blood.
Wow. Well, thanks for that. I didn't, you know, it's never come up. So thank you. I think it's a good thing to know about.
Handy dandy tip. If you think that you are being victimized by a psychic vampire, first thing, move out of whatever room you're in. If you're interacting with people, the highest likelihood is it's someone that you just interacted with in the past 15 minutes. It's probably someone who either made physical contact or eye contact with you. It's probably somebody who talked to you. They may not be aware that they are taking your energy and that they're feeding off of you, which makes it kind of awkward to ask them to stop. So if you move yourself out of their sphere of control, out of their space, you're likely to break their contact, their focus on you. And then just, you know, step into a bathroom or somewhere where you can control the space. Take a few moments to collect yourself, kind of check in to make sure that what you're feeling isn't just, you know, a panic attack or, you know, acid reflux or something worse that's just purely physical. And if you're still 100% sure this is an energetic thing, go through that step that I suggested with turn on the taps on the water, put your hands under the water, feel the water going over your wrists and your hands, bring yourself back into your body. Remind yourself that you do have boundaries and assert those boundaries through whatever method of shielding works for you, whether that is the ball of white light or actually calling on a higher power. But make sure that by the end of it, you have a strong sense of where you begin and the rest of the world ends, and also that you have both the right and also that you are carrying your protections, that you have a right to be protected, that you are not a victim.
So how is this different than obsessing spirits?
Oh, I don't find too much of a difference. Some of it depends on the ultimate influence and intent of the spirit. Obsessing spirits that are trying to obsess or oppress a person will kind of connect to that person. Think of them like psychic lampreys or leeches. Uh-huh. They make a connection to the person, and sometimes they're content to just, you know, slurp off a little of your energy and your vitality.
Yeah, slurp off a little.
Some of them need a little bit more of an emotional engagement. Again, think about those psychic vampire examples where strong emotional reactions get more out of the engagement. So some obsessing entities prefer terror, prefer your pain, prefer your depression, and they will find ways to incite those reactions. They will exude them until you mistake those emotions for your own and feed back into whatever cycle they prefer. In my opinion, some of the most devastating psychic attacks and spiritual attacks aren't things randomly scratching you or pushing you. It's something that puts out a miasma of negative emotion that's so subtle you don't realize it's not yours. Before you know it, you're just sort of soaked in icky, horrible negativity, whether it's depression or stuff that verges on suicidal ideation or anger and rage and fury. And you're so saturated, you no longer stop to ask, why do I feel like this? Is this me? You just act on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this different than possession?
Yes. There are sort of stages that lead up to possession. That can be a stage that leads to full possession, but not everything is trying to possess people. Some spirits really are motivated to want to crawl around in a person's skin. I think of them a little bit, at least some of them, like teenagers that want to joyride in a car. Mm-hmm. They don't really care so much about the body, at least not in the long term. They want something out of being able to be in a physical body, whether it's pleasure, whether it's causing violence, whether it's just the thrill of it. So it usually goes oppression, obsession, possession, where something is sort of, think of it in terms of orbit. Something is orbiting near you and starting to have an influence on how you feel. Something has attached to the outside of you and is having a more significant impact on how you think, how you feel, how you react. And then something finds a way inside of you, has worn you down to a point where it can steer some of your movements, make you say things, make you do things. Maybe you're conscious while this is happening, and maybe it's full possession where the person who was born into that body is shoved in a corner and may have no recollection of the possessory state. Now, that sounds terrifying. And mm-hmm. I think it's important to mention that there are a number of religious and spiritual traditions where that is a desired state under certain circumstances. Voodoo is probably the best example, where transpossessory states are a part of worship and spirit interaction, but there are very, very clear circumstances under which that is engaged with. There's structure, there's protections in place so that you know broadly what's going to take you over and how. And there are people there to basically act as your spotters.
Thank you so much to Michelle Bellinger. And if you want to hear just a little bit more, go to patreon.com/rozdresvelez. In my second tier, you can hear what Michelle has to say about human spirits possessing living humans. Also, go get you some ghosted merch in the description of this episode and a ticket to the live show, which will be happening on the 30th. In Silver Lake, Los Angeles, California. You can find that link in this description of this episode. And I should also tell you that Michelle will be back next week, and we get into religions, and we're talking more occult stuff, and it's fantastic. So make sure you're subscribed. Tell your friends about the show. Rate it 5 stars if you like it. If you don't like it, why are you listening? If you have a ghost story, you could leave it in a 5-star review. You could put it in our Facebook group called Ghosted by Roz Dresvelez. I want to do a listener episode again soon, so send those on over to ghostedbyroz@gmail.com with the subject line listener episode. You can find me on Instagram at Roz Hernandez. I'm on Cameo Roz Dresvelez. Wow, I have a lot to say about myself. I love you all. Both living and dead.
But if I didn't ask you to haunt me, don't haunt me. Okay, bye!
Starburns Avenue, a podcast, a podcast network.